to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
In his new book, Mere Science and Christian Faith, theologian Greg Cuzzona argues against the idea that science and faith are inherently antagonistic. For 18 years, he served as a pastor in Chico at Bidwell Presbyterian Church and now teaches religious studies and humanities at Chico State University. He has been studying science and religion for almost three decades and written several books, including C.S. Lewis and the Crisis of a Christian. Greg Cuzzona has a Ph.D. from the Graduate Theological Union at Berkeley and directs Science and Theology for Emerging Adult Ministries at Fuller Theological Seminary. Greg Cuzzona, welcome. You know, you give your background in your book, this new book, Mere Science and Christian Faith, and I'd like to start with that, how you came to be. You were originally a functional atheist, would you say?
I would use those terms, yes, Nancy.
In fact, you
right.
did in your book.
Yeah.
So how did you leave that behind?
Well, if you don't mind, I'm going to read from one of the pages in the introduction, the first chapter at least.
Please do.
I was bottle-fed on the casual, happy secularism of the region now known as Silicon Valley. I grew up not needing God because I was satisfied by superb weather, comfortable surroundings, and a sufficient degree of personal achievement. If I had a theological creed, it was agnosticism or functional atheism. To be clear, I was a buoyant secular Northern Californian, not some kind of dour atheistic postmodernist. To me, and many around me, the existence of a deity didn't seem relevant or advantageous. So it was easy for me to wander the path set by a self-sufficient San Mateo County, where just a small percentage of residents could be caught in church on any given Sunday. Recently, the Barna Group found Oakland, San Francisco, San Jose, altogether, to be the number one unchurched and dechurched region in the country, followed closely by Chico and Redding, where I live now. Though the title didn't exist at the time, I could count my early self as a nun. And I can't deny that some residual nunness still flows through my veins.
Would you mind me interrupting to spell
no.
that nun?
Yes.
Not N-U-N, but...
N-O-N-E. Yeah, so, you know, that's that idea that if you were asked, which religion are you, and you had boxes to check, and they're, you know, Christian, Muslim, pagan, etc., and there was one mark none, you'd mark that box. So you do not affiliate in any way. So I would count my early self as a nun, and I can't deny that some residual nunness still flows through my veins. It's certainly still the cultural air I breathe. At age 17, I started at the University of California, Berkeley, and shortly thereafter became a follower of Christ. I admit it. Grow up in a secular home, go to Berkeley, become a Christian. It is almost laughable, but that is what happened.
You know, it actually does make me laugh, Greg.
I say it's a, when I talk sometimes, this should sound like an oxymoron, and it really is an unusual story in that way.
It is, because I know people who are raised in, say, the Protestant church growing up, and they go off to college and come in contact with science majors and physics majors and say, hey, that stuff I grew up with, I don't believe any of that stuff. And so they're walking out the church door when you're walking in.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, and I certainly come into contact with those students today at Chico State, where I teach. And many of them are simply trying to find out what their worldview is. So if they've had, you know, this church background, they're trying to figure out, is it still mine, or maybe it's just not where they are anymore. So yeah, it was a reversal. And the thing for me, which was interesting, is so many 18 to 30-year-olds now are nuns, these not religiously affiliating, like 35 to 40%. And in some ways, it gives me a kind of affinity with them, even though I'm decades removed from that demographic.
My guest is Greg Cuzzona, and he has just read from his book, Mere Science and Christian Faith. And you were at Berkeley, and I can just imagine you might not have wanted to go around saying that you became a follower of Christ, because you're probably not going to get much sympathy from your fellow students.
Well, it was really interesting. Overall, that was true. I was also living in a fraternity at the time, and they weren't as supportive, shall we say, of a Christian lifestyle as other environments might have been. Now, having said that, of course, there were friends that were Christians and other people that I connected with. But it was a little imposing. And other students were really smart at Berkeley and were really much more conversant about why they didn't believe. One of my classmates in the comparative literature department named Mark, he was this brilliant post-Christian who knew Hegel and Kant and Derrida and Foucault and just had every argument down. And at some level, it was like all of a sudden swimming with Olympiads and learning what the breaststroke was like or something, you know?
Well, you did mention, and I guess this was your introduction to C.S. Lewis, mm-hmm. that you said, these friends handed me various books, many now forgotten, with the exception of the Bible and works by C.S. Lewis. Mere Christianity, which described Lewis's intellectual disenchantment with atheism, it got under my skin with reason and reasonable approach to Christian faith. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned that because later on you wrote a book. You were inspired by C.S. Lewis to write a whole book about him.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, I know.
And even the title of your current book, Mere Science, is paraphrasing his Mere Christianity.
It is indeed. Yeah, and sometimes in the book I use that phrase to bring together mainstream science and mere Christianity. That's the focus of the book. So, yes, Lewis has this ongoing influence for me, and he was a person that, as I said, with this reasonable faith, made such a difference because so much of what I had heard in the Christian world or from the Christian world had been not very reasonable and had seemed kind of shallow to me, to be honest. So Lewis was really helpful, and he also set a certain agenda for me at Berkeley because he was in this world-class university of Oxford and then later Cambridge and really had a Christian voice in various ways. One of them was this Oxford Socratic Club that debated ideas. And so he had this sense that a person of faith could engage in the ideas of a secular university and have a fruitful interchange. And even though Lewis was not a scientist, he understood what the impact of science was culturally. And at this point in my life, I was really taking in that science had an amazing impact and taking in from my professors that the scientific mindset was kind of the universal acid that would, you know, corrode my faith. So it was really Lewis who was a sort of patron saint, you know, to help me out in this endeavor.
Well, you mentioned your professors at Berkeley, and I was interested in the fact that a professor visited from Germany, mm-hmm. and you were interested in this because your own mother was of German background. Mm-hmm. And what did this German professor have to say, Greg?
That was a great moment. I mean, and also a little bit of a shocking moment. So I was doing comparative literature, ancient Greek and modern French, and we had a comparative religion professor come who was German-speaking, Friederike Hassauer. I mention her by name in the book because I don't think she'd be embarrassed by what she'd said, but I thought, well, my parents are coming into town from Menlo Park to Berkeley, about a 50-mile drive, and let's have them meet this professor. So we were talking about so many nice things and sharing about Europe and everything else at this downtown restaurant, Upstart and Crow, where you could read books and have your hamburgers. And right in the middle of that, I had been maybe a follower of Christ for about a year or so, but I was sort of bumbling in it because of still kind of young, and I was came out that I was a person of faith, but in a very mild way that I believed in God. And she,
just like you might say, pass the ketchup for my hamburger.
Totally. Or I grew up in Menlo Park, or I played tennis or whatever. Exactly. It was very casual. And she looked at me in the way that I know German society does and is very direct sometimes and said, I wish I could do her accent. I wouldn't do it justice. But how can you believe in God after Hume and Kant and all the arguments that they bring? I probably have a closer rendering of that in the book, but it was a memorable moment, and that was the basic assumption that so many of my professors had, that, you know, this was done, this idea of faith was done, and there was really no place for it if you wanted to be a thinking person.
So I don't think she was unique in her point of view. She just expressed what a lot of the other professors believed.
That's right. And I think, you know, in the culture of Western Europe, it's much more common to be okay with being atheist. And I think that's partly, by the way, now it's about 30 years later where we are, I think, in the United States, that we are becoming more comfortable with atheism. So anyway, that's something we might be able to get into. But, you know, it showed me that Christian faith was not seen as something that was robust and able to take on modern scientific and technological thinking.
My guest is Greg Cuzzona. His newest book is Mere Science and Christian Faith, Bridging the Divide with Emerging Adults. Now, that raises some questions in my mind. First of all, Greg, you're saying emerging adults? What happened to just young people or young adults? Why don't you just say young adults?
Yes. It's a term that's been in, I guess, development for the last 17 years. Jeffrey Arnett came up with this idea of emerging adults. And essentially, it's that so many of the markers of adulthood, by the way, Arnett is not a theological voice, a psychologist. So many of the markers of becoming an adult are being delayed. So getting a job, getting married, having children, having your own house, those are being delayed. So that about two-thirds of people in the 1960s would have had these four or five markers, quote unquote, satisfied or whatever. They would have achieved them, if you want to use that language.
In fact, when I saw your age range for who you were calling emerging adults, I thought, good grief, till 30?
Yes.
You mean all the way through their 20s?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
But then I read your explanation. I thought, true.
There's just so many more options when you, I mean, it's the positive and negative. It's not necessarily to say people aren't, you know, maturing, but they're much more flexible because of that. So if they're not yet married, they have many more options with who their partner will be, you know, in life. At the same time, there might be a tremendous anxiety. They're not getting the job at IBM at age 25 that they're going to have for 40 years and then retire with a pension. So there's also this anxiety to it. And so that's the idea of emerging adulthood. It's not it's not meant to be pejorative, certainly, but the idea that this being a fully what we have considered to be adulthood is just taking a much longer time. And as part of that, there's this approach to all kinds of things fueled by the internet and the possibilities we see there that allows us to have a much more diverse opinion and to put off choices for a lot longer period than we previously had. So that's the emerging adult paradigm to which I wanted to speak.
So you write this book and you say on your cover, Bridging the Divide with Emerging Adults. So that's one demographic that you aim this book for, that you hope will read this book. Who else did you write this book for? Maybe you'd like to read that in your book.
Yeah, I have this passage from the intro. I use this idea of a manifesto and a field guide. So primarily this particular book is written to church leaders who engage in their work with 18 to 30-year-olds. This book is aimed primarily at pastors and emerging adult ministry leaders, as well as 18 to 30-year-olds who take science and scripture seriously. It should serve as both a manifesto and a field guide. As a manifesto, it's designed to convince you that the church must embrace mainstream science for its future. My hope is that you'll do something as a result of reading the pages that follow, that you'll write some new, true narratives that integrate scripture and science, and that you will speak to emerging adults. Some of the narratives will develop from the 18 to 30-year-old lives you'll influence. As a field guide, this book presents a picture of what it looks like to pursue this kind of work, the challenging mountains, the gorgeous vistas, the dangerous sinkholes, and the peaceful meadows. Now, I think just to add to that, I recognize that in this demographic to which I'm particularly speaking, which is the thoughtful evangelical church, and the publisher is a publisher that particularly connects with that demographic, I recognize that there is often a resistance to science. And so in this case, I'm trying to, honestly, to persuade that we should not resist science, and I give some reasons for that. So there is another side to this work, which is that I think it's good for our culture if the church, just the culture at large, if the church, the Christians in the United States, engage mainstream science. But here I'm looking at mainly the side of church leaders and the reasons they need to engage mainstream science.
Well, I assumed as I was reading this, because you have quotes from students in your book, and I assumed that they were all Chico State University students because I know you teach classes there. But you say we had target groups in New York City, Menlo Park, as well as Chico.
Yes. Yeah, most of the quotes do come from these hour-long interviews I've been doing over the past 3 years with mainly Chico State students, but there are a few others, and particularly looking at this demographic of 18 to 30-year-olds. Yeah.
This is...
But I have done other target groups with, as you said, the Silicon Valley, New York City, that look at what changes people's minds. That was the particular interest in that those demographics. What's the secret sauce that helps people to see an integration between science and faith to be a positive thing? If you don't mind me just adding one component to that, I think for a lot of people in the Christian church, there's this resistance to science and sometimes a fear of science. And I, because of the background I've mentioned and because of my own studies subsequently and my PhD and so on, I just don't hold that opinion. And I know there's a lot of good reasons not to come to that conclusion. So I think this is something that I want to try to persuade, honestly. I want to make a difference. I want to say, no, this is – science is actually, in my language, a gift from God. These discoveries are something that we learn because of the goodness of the Creator. So in that way, there's no reason to be fearful of it. And so that's the group that I really – honestly, I want to persuade, and I want to persuade the leaders to persuade people. You know, I want to influence the influencers, as it were.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. After a break, I'll continue my conversation with Greg Cuzzona, author of Mere Science and Christian Faith, Bridging the Divide with Emerging Adults. Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is theologian Greg Cuzzona, who says that science and faith are not inherently antagonistic. His latest book is Mere Science and Christian Faith, Bridging the Divide with Emerging Adults. Well, I know that you work with this age group, so when I looked at the title of your book and I thought, well, Emerging Adults, yeah, he works with that group, so that makes sense he would write this book for them. But I also considered the fact that if you wrote for an older group, say older than 30, I just imagine their opinions are set. And Greg, you are not going to change their mind. In fact, they don't even want to hear such a book exists that you wrote, Greg, because I believe whatever it is they believe. And you're not going to be able to dissuade me from that.
You mean people much older than us, of course, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is there are often some frozen positions that happen. Absolutely. And it seems to me that this demographic is more open, even if they are committed to a particular, you know, faith tradition. And again, I'm talking within the Christian church. And as a sidebar, I'm working on a whole other project which engages various religious traditions and the sciences. So that's another interest of mine. But within the church, I do think, yes, there seems to be more openness with a younger demographic. Now, having said that, what's really fascinating to me is that some older demographics have a little bit more openness because they have more time sometimes. My experience has been in teaching in the church for 20 plus years that when people are in the maelstrom of trying to raise kids and do their jobs and those sorts of things, it's easier to be fixed. But some of my best conversations have been with the empty nester, you know, seniors that have the time to reflect and may not feel like they know everything anymore. Right.
My guest is Greg Cuzzona. And among the books that he's written is his newest book, Mere Science and Christian Faith, Bridging the Divide with Emerging Adults. And the very fact that you say science and faith in the same in the title raises the question, well, for example, just the word Christian. I mean, if one person says, I'm a Christian, another person can say they're a Christian, and they could not, they might share more views with somebody from the Jewish faith than they do other Christians.
Yeah. And I think that, I'm sorry if I'm interrupting what you're saying, but I think with the recent death of Billy Graham being, quote, America's pastor, one of the things that's often been said is there anybody that could emerge like that today? Because we don't have that, maybe that kind of consensus in the Christian church. Yes, yeah.
And it was during his time that we added the Pledge of Allegiance.
Right, yeah, that's right.
Under God.
Yeah, that's right.
That and there would not happen today.
I don't think it would happen today. No, that's really interesting. And so, yes, I mean, I think there's a variety of Christians. And for me, partly this is a strategic engagement. I think we need to work with those, engage with those people who are Orthodox in their faith. So they could read down, you know, the basic creeds of the Christian church, like the Nicene Creed or the Apostles' Creed, and say, this is what I believe, and are thoughtful. They want to engage in the process of what does it mean to bring their mind to their faith, and thus science and technology as well. So I recognize that it's impossible to speak for the entire Christian faith, but I try to speak within that great tradition and to make a difference potentially for people to see the benefits that science can bring to their life and to their devotion and to what they believe.
Now, you just mentioned the Nicene Creed. Maybe for those who aren't familiar or their memory's a little rusty, explain what you mean by that.
Yes. So the Nicene Creed was written probably around 381 after the Council of Nicaea in 325, which was a church, you know, convening. And it defines what Christian belief is. Like, I believe in God, the Father, creator of heaven and earth, and, you know, I believe in Jesus Christ, and I believe in the Holy Spirit. So it's been a defining mark for Christian orthodoxy for a while. And I, maybe another way to put it is it's a way of identifying what C.S. Lewis was talking about with mere Christianity. And he picked that term up from a Reformed thinker by the name of Richard Baxter. And the idea is there's been this consensus that draws a lot of people together within the body of the Christian church. Apparently, there's about 2.2 billion Christians in the world, so it's hard to speak for any body that is that, you know, that was is that expansive. But there seem to be some things which bring most Christians together.
Well, I know people who are raised in the Protestant church repeating the Nicene Creed at every service, and suddenly they begin to realize, what am I saying?
I'm saying
I believe this, but I don't. I don't believe this.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, and what's so interesting to me is that in the Nicene Creed or the Apostles' Creed, which is another form, a little shorter, very similar kind of statement, there's really nothing about science in there that one would have to worry about, you know, in terms of engaging modern science. So things like we talk about the age of the Earth, you know, and the age of the universe being 13.7 billion years old, age of the Earth 4.6 or so billion, and those aren't things that are threatened. The basic belief for Christians is not threatened by those things. And in the book, I use what's often in this book, Mere Science and Christian Faith, I use this metaphor of the two books. It's been an ongoing metaphor that God is the author of two books, the book of Scripture and the book of nature, and that they are the same author, so they complement one another. And in this case, the point would be that we can say that God is creator, but we don't have to say how God is created. You know, that so there's that space for science to do the work that it does. Or another one that I was just thinking about was we can say in the, you know, we can read in the book of Scripture, be thankful, be grateful. These are, you know, very often stated. And then you can look to the kind of scientific work that, say, Robert Emmons does down at Davis, where you look at the science of gratitude and we realize that it's good for us. So that's the kind of environment in which I think science and faith can be very complementary and mutually enhancing, you know, for a person of faith. I really am writing this for a person of faith. I realize there'll be many people who will do different things with science. But in this case, I'm writing to the church as a kind of apology, meaning a kind of defense of you. It's a good idea to do this work.
Well, now, you mentioned Davis, and you tell in your book that there was a graduate student at the University of California, Davis, who came up for a conference, I think, that
yes,
you gave.
Yes, here at the church, yeah, Bidwell Presbyterian, yeah.
Yeah, and I was looking for her quote because she said, "Why doesn't the church teach us this?"
Yeah, yes. Yeah, really great young woman, Sarah, and she, I think in that was a kind, it was, she had grown up with some input that she needed to resist, particularly evolutionary science, and that I was working with C.S. Lewis and Tim Keller, who's a leading evangelical pastor in New York City and writer, and John Stott, who was a leading British evangelical, and demonstrating that we can take in biological evolutionary theory and relate it to the doctrine, the teaching of creation and other kinds of teachings in the church, and to see, to show how these thinkers, these very orthodox thinkers, had done it. And I think Sarah was so excited about that and felt like it was a release and a freedom for her to be able to do that. So do you mind if I give one other little story?
Oh,
to this?
Sure.
So Sarah's a wonderfully winsome person, and I think in general the biggest issue for Christians often is just to note that science doesn't have to be an atheistic endeavor. And my hope is to encourage Christians to go into the sciences, like Francis Collins, who heads the National Institutes of Health, or Jennifer Wiseman, who I'm going to be with later this week with a group she convenes called the Dialogue on Science, Ethics, and Religion for the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Those thinkers are the kinds of Christians that are demonstrating that science doesn't need to be either against the church, against belief, but it can also be a legitimate Christian vocation. So having said that, it's just a truth that biological evolution is one of the most tested sets of theories that have been, that guide science and have done so for over 150 years now. And I often will tell, and some churches are not going to be able to engage with that. And I understand that. I want them to, because I want them to hear biological evolution from somebody like Francis Collins, who subscribes to it like 98% of scientists do, honestly. And in the AAAS, which is this large organization of, you know, believers and non-believers and all kinds of different stripes, and to see that biological evolution doesn't lead to atheism, like you might hear from a Richard Dawkins or a Jerry Coyne.
Now, speaking of Richard Dawkins, your position is made a little more difficult that 20 years ago, young people didn't have access to the internet, and now they can turn on YouTube and see Richard Dawkins saying, "You idiot."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, and Dawkins is so brilliant. I mean, he absolutely is brilliant. And he's a great biologist, when he used to practice more biology. He doesn't really do that much today. But here's the thing that's so interesting, Nancy. You mentioned that in my class, I have my students in my science and religion class at Chico State read Richard Dawkins and Francis Collins talking in a Time magazine article about their views, because they came out with both of their main books about the same time, The Language of God and The God Delusion. And then I have the students watch two videos. One is Francis Collins doing a lecture at UC Berkeley on his book, and one is Richard Dawkins doing his TED Talk. And I tell the students, I don't care how you come out on this question. I just want you to support your answer, you know, and show the reasons for it. Look at which these two thinkers say, restate some of the reasons they are convinced of what they're saying, and then say which one you think is more convincing and why. It is so interesting, and this has been actually validated in further surveys from, for example, Elaine Eklund at Rice University, who does some of the best work in social science on these topics, that my students prefer Francis Collins to Richard Dawkins. They think that overall, there's some that say Richard Dawkins speaks for me. He's saying things that I absolutely think are true, and he's given voice, right? And he makes more sense. But actually, the majority of my students, and this is Chico State, so it's not like we're sifting out for people of particular convictions one way or the other in terms of religion. They'll say, I preferred Francis Collins. I preferred him because he talked about science and because he was not so negative. Because Dawkins has ironic, sarcastic side, and Collins just doesn't. So,
arrogant.
Yeah, there's an arrogance to him. He's just such a brilliant, you know, stylistically, rhetorically brilliant guy, but he can be caustic, you know. And they actually like Collins's presentation better, and they say, I never knew that there were people like this who were mainstream scientists who engaged also with Christian faith. So that in and of itself is always an interesting lesson to me. I mean, it's like a continual learning over the past 4 years as I've taught the class.
My guest is Greg Cuzzona. He teaches religious studies and humanities at Chico State University, so he is in contact with this age group that he writes about, that he writes for, in his new book, Mere Science and Christian Faith. And I spent a lot of time looking at your cover, Greg. I don't know how much input you had.
Very little, but they did such a nice job.
It is really, and it looks three-dimensional. It's not, but it looks three-dimensional and very scientific, but I see no Christian symbols on the cover.
I thought that was interesting, too. Yeah, I, as I said, I didn't have any particular input on the title, on the cover. I did have a title. But yes, they really, it's kind of like molecules looking and sort of space and behind it. Yes, I think they wanted the, as far as I know, the publisher, InterVarsity Press, wanted to have a sense of engagement with the scientific, with science, with the discoveries of science. So that's my best guess. I have to say, I kind of like just like the colors.
And yeah, and that's very eye-catching. Colorful.
Yeah.
Something else I noticed that often if a book has quotes in it or some information, they put it in a sidebar, a
yes.
box.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of quotes from students, and they're in circles.
Isn't
like
that cool?
Bubbles.
Isn't that fun?
Float. Yeah.
It sort of looks like the little molecules on there. Yeah.
Yes. It yeah. reflects the molecules on your cover.
Yeah.
And I thought that was very clever. It was very pleasant visually.
I very much agree. And as you asked, you don't have a lot of input on that. So I was really happy with how it came out. And so that's always a positive. I mean, authoring is a funny thing. There's so much you do that's, you know, in your room by yourself. Nobody really knows. And then it emerges a few, this is like 9 months later after you've finished it, and you don't really know what it's going to look like. So here it is, and it looks nice on the cover, and we're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but why not in this case? Can I tell one other story?
Yes.
Is that okay? I didn't put this into the book, but it goes back to this question of how do we engage mainstream science and even evolutionary thought or other things, you know, neuroscientific thought, et cetera. And it was a big realization I had, which was actually post book. So I'm going to have to put it in a post book talks. But when I went to Berkeley, as I mentioned, I did comparative literature, and I'd just become a follower of Christ. And I thought I wanted to read the Bible in the original language. So I studied ancient Greek, the Greek of Plato and Aristotle, which also comprises the Greek that the New Testament is written in. And when I went to Princeton Seminary a few years later and became ordained and so on after that, the Greek I learned at Berkeley at a secular university was no different. It was absolutely a flat platform, you might say, from one to the other, from Berkeley to Princeton Theological Seminary. There was no sense of you have to learn some new Greek here. I'm afraid that too many Christians think that the science they learn at CSU Chico or UC Berkeley or Columbia University, where my daughter went, or UC Irvine, where my other daughter goes, you're going to have to unlearn that for their Christian faith. Now, if anything should be clear, it should be that the most sacred text that we revere as Christians is important to us, but we're trusting the Greek that we learn in any university. But we're not trusting the science that, as I said, 97-98% of scientists subscribe to, which is, the theorem of biological evolution through natural selection. And so I want Christians to understand that. I want Christians to grasp that this is just the lingua franca, the common language of science. And my job is not, I'm not a scientist. My job is as a theologian to interpret that and say, well, what is the effect on our faith? And if you read the book, you can see how it affects different teachings. But essentially, I would say, in shorthand, it does not nullify anything I would read in the Bible or anything I would read in the Apostles or Nicene Creed. And so that's a really critical thing, a critical insight about this taking on knowledge that is common human knowledge and seeing it as something that comes ultimately actually from God the Creator.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. We're going to take a short break, and then I'll continue my conversation about the interconnections of science and faith with author Greg Cuzzona. Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, author Greg Cuzzona, author of Mere Science and Christian Faith, Bridging the Divide with Emerging Adults. There are terms that you use. We mentioned Christian. There's not necessarily agreement on that. And even the word faith. So you have a section in your book where you define some of these terms that you use, like the word faith.
Mm-hmm,
what
yes.
do you mean by that?
Well, I think in this case, I'm talking about the content of faith primarily. So there's two sides, the subjective side, which is that I have faith in X, Y, or Z. So I have faith that God will lead my life in a way that's beneficial. That's one, the subjective view of faith. I'm thinking more of the objective view. So what is the content of my faith? So let's say I believe that God is the creator, that God created all that is, which doesn't mean that God shaped things that already existed. It doesn't mean that something kind of emanated from God in a necessary way. It means that God, out of a free choice, from nothing, there was no thing, created this world. So that would be a content of faith. Or I believe in Jesus Christ as the revelation, unique revelation of God. That is a content of faith. And that's the kind of Christian faith that I'm thinking about in this book.
Well, there's another term that you use that needs definition because I'd never come across hermeneutics.
Oh, hermeneutics, yes. And I borrowed a title from my brother. He's a really funny writer, on a crash course with hermeneutics. Now, this is actually interesting because when I was doing my comparative literature studies at Berkeley, we talked about hermeneutics as a literary phenomenon. So how do you interpret a text? How do you understand? So hermeneutics comes from the Greek word Hermes, which is the messenger god. So how does a text carry, like Hermes would carry, its meaning to us? And so I learned it first in secular studies, but it's particularly important in looking at the Bible. And one of the kinds of decisions that's not hard for a person to make, let's say a Christian who's committed to saying the Bible is a revelation of God. To say that if God created in 6 days, as in the book of Genesis, that those days could last a long, long time. Days don't have to be 24 hours. And I think that's a hermeneutical question, right? So you could say, I read these texts, I read Genesis 1, 2, and I see, especially Genesis 1, and I see these days of creation with the seventh day of rest, and yeah, I could see that as, I can still believe it to be true, but I can see that as a long period of time. So that would be the kind of hermeneutical question that I think is critical. And I will quote, as I said, one of my patron saints, St. Clive Lewis, Clive Staples Lewis. And he was really fascinating to me because in his work on the Bible, he noted that the Bible, for one thing, is not a science textbook. And that even the assumption that the Bible needs to be a science textbook is a kind of weird way to make science the arbiter of all truth, so that things can be true even if they aren't scientific in that sense. They can be powerful narratives and powerful stories. That can be true. So when Jesus, for example, tells the story of, let's say, the parable of the prodigal son, this son is returning who's run away from his father, and the father embraces him with love. That is a powerful story. It doesn't ever have to happen in some kind of literal sense, but it's a powerful story. And so Lewis said these stories we have in the Bible are powerful stories. We don't need to worry about whether they are scientific to be true in the way that we might want them to be scientific. They can be true and persuasive and authoritative without that kind of verification.
You had a quote that's often attributed to Einstein that, and I may have the phrasing backwards, but everything that counts cannot be counted.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Or everything that can be counted is not necessarily what counts.
Counts, right, yeah, yeah. That's a great saying. And it, if you don't mind my just saying something about that.
Yes.
I mean, I think what that's getting at is in the science and technological world that we're in, we are counting so many things and we can manipulate so many things. I mean, this amazing studio that we're in, you know, it has so many technological advancements. The fact that we can do this recording is based on incredible amounts of science and technology. So we begin to count, you know, the zeros and ones in digital recording or whatever. And that doesn't mean that those material things are the end of the day, right?
And yet some people believe that.
Right.
If you cannot prove it with science, then it does not exist.
Right.
So don't talk to me about God and all these invisible things that you can't prove.
That's correct, yeah. And that we can't count. I mean, and I think that's where...
And not reproducible. And two people do an experiment. We want to see that it comes out the same for whoever's doing the experiment.
That's right, absolutely. And I think that's the glory of science. But as the quantum physicist John Polkinghorne says, there's a limited aspirations to science. I mean, he loves science. He was one of the key physicists at Cambridge. But he said that's the limited aspirations of science, that it is fixed on what can be, you know, counted, right? And so we recognize, I think, as human beings that we can't count everything. I mean, I'd like to think that the reason that Laura, my wife, and I can stay married for 37 years is not because we counted how many cards we wrote or how many times we made dinner or how many times laundry was done. But there's something that's broader than that. And you know, there's quantifiability at some level, but that we, I believe as human beings, we know there's something more powerful. When I'm going to do my jazz show here at KCHO, and when a great song comes forward, and I just get moved sometimes in the studio, you know, in the middle, it seems like the middle of the night, you know, late evening. It's like, wow, that is just so powerful. It's not based on some number or some volume level or whatever. It's something beyond that. And so that's what I think Einstein was about. I think that's a critical move to see how to put science and religion together.
My guest is Greg Cuzzona, and his latest book is Mere Science and Christian Faith, Bridging the Divide with Emerging Adults. You mentioned the book of Genesis in the Bible, and it starts out, in the beginning was the Word.
That's actually John.
John.
Yes, that's right.
John. But that beginning of the Word is not just limited to our culture. You go to India, and that's how things were created, with sound, with the Word. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I did realize that was John that said that. But I want to get back to
Genesis. Well, in a way, you could say, in the beginning, God speaks in Genesis 1.
Yes.
So there's a very similar feel. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. And spoke creation into being.
Yes.
But now this story with Adam and Eve, wow, did you open a can of worms, Greg?
May I just say one thing about the Word? I'm not trying to to miss or to evade what you're asking about with Adam and Eve, because that's central. But it's interesting that in string theory today, there's this sense of vibrations that exist at these different levels and dimensions that we can't even see, and that words are based on vibrations. And I'm going to quote Lewis one more time, because I think one of the most beautiful views of creation is when his Christ figure, Aslan, creates the world by singing. So it's just a tremendous image. And again, I'm speaking to the Christian church. If I were to talk to my religious studies department or my religion classes, I would note that, like you said, in India, in our Native American text, singing and vibration is really critical to creation.
Like the Rig Veda was not written down for years. The Indians' holy scriptures, mm-hmm. they were not written down. They were recited.
Right, right. They're what is remembered, right? Yeah,
yes.
That's so interesting. Yeah. So Adam and Eve, I don't want to evade that, because it's really a topic that's come up so much in this kind of literature in the past few months. And essentially, and I think this is what's going to hit a lot of people as a somewhat controversial topic. So, but I'll give it away and hope that people want to read the book anyway. That I think, you know, where Adam and Eve hits Christians is Adam and Eve are the people who are the paradigmatic human beings in the Bible. They define what it is to be human. So if we in some ways find that those aren't like us, or they're kind of, you know, what you find is disappointing, it begins to affect us. Like I said, the age of the earth, I don't really think is as big an issue as Adam and Eve. And so what I do in the book is I lay out three different positions. I say there's the kind of young earth creationist position where the earth is 6 to 10,000 years old. Adam and Eve are specially created in the Garden of Eden. And there are many Christians who believe that and are subscribed to it. I cannot, in the view that I'm taking, subscribe to it. It just does not simply line up with so many areas of modern science. So I try not to offend anybody, but I know I'm not going to really take on that perspective. The third perspective that C.S. Lewis and others lays out is that the development of Adam and Eve in taking on the ability to obey or disobey God, which we see in these stories, especially in Genesis 2 and 3, the second and third chapter of the book of Genesis, is the emergence of human consciousness and the ability to have self-transcendence. And so in itself, it's not a literal story, but a story of paradigmatic humanity. And so this is the view that Lewis takes and many other contemporary people. And what I want to do with my constituency for this book is say that's a legitimate orthodox position. There is nothing in the salvation through Jesus Christ that the church has proclaimed and held to that is threatened by that position. And, you know, this patron saint of evangelicalism, but really of worldwide Christendom, C.S. Lewis, also subscribed to that. Now, let me just, if I may, I don't want to rush this too much, but to say that the second position is in between, and my friend Gary Fugel here, who used to teach at Butte College, and another friend, Josh Swamidas, who's at the Washington University at St. Louis, says that, no, you can still have a special creation, even with human development and evolution and so on, of two people, Adam and Eve, who affected a population group. So that preserves a lot more of what people want to see in the text and want to read from read in the text, while allowing for much of the anthropological studies and conclusions that science comes to.
Well, I mentioned my interest in language and words, like in the beginning was logos.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Or if you use the French translator has to choose between a couple of words for a word. Mm-hmm. Do you mean the written word or do you mean the spoken word?
Oh, yes.
But I was interested in the fact that when this story of Adam and Eve was written in Hebrew, the word Adam and the word Eve have meanings that if we know this meaning, it gives a different picture.
That's right. I mean, somebody called it to be dusty, which is, Adam from the dust, and Eve is mama, kind of, and it's the mother of all living.
Yeah, so we could call them dusty and mama.
Right, and if you started there and just took that, you would say, this doesn't look like a purely historical text right there. And then you also know that even if it was 10,000 years ago, Hebrew wasn't yet a language. So we're already giving them Hebrew names for people that probably that wasn't their language. So there's,
but the word for human was the word Adam in Hebrew.
That's right. So also
and
the word
Eve. So they were named according to Hebrew words.
That's
they
correct.
Were assigned these names.
Right.
And we now it comes down. We've lost that information. So Adam,
back to translation. Back to the problem of translation. That's right. Yeah. So like you said, important to just underline. Adam also just means the human being, right? And Eve means the mother of the living. So that's also this they're kind of what I would call paradigmatic or typological characters. And I think I always have to say that doesn't mean that I'm undoing a historical Jesus or the history of all the things that Christians hold to, but I don't think we need Adam and Eve to be historical for that to be true. But like I said, there are some Christians that and good scientists who have ways that put those together, that special creation of these human beings with scientific, mainstream science. So I think there's some room to work here, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
So you have a chapter in your book about Adam and Eve. And some of you have a chapter on hermeneutics. You have what you call a crash course in that. And your book has various chapters, and one is a case study. What about intelligent design?
Yes. Well, so intelligent design is a particular paradigm of understanding biological life. And I think a lot of people get confused because they think it just means that there's an intelligent designer. And that would be something that I would think, well, not just Christians, Muslims and Jews would also subscribe to, as well as many other people, but just go with monotheism, that there's an intelligent designer is just part of believing that there's a God who created. The intelligent design paradigm has a couple of other elements, and it was presented as an alternative to biological evolution, the standard mainstream theory. The idea being that there's these points in the development of a biological life that are irreducibly complex, so that they couldn't come about with incremental change. And essentially, it's just not been sustained as a scientific paradigm. That would be the shorthand version of it. And that's sad, but it's less prominent now than it was, say, 15, 20 years ago.
My guest is theologian and college professor Greg Cuzzona. His newest book is Mere Science and Christian Faith, Bridging the Divide with Emerging Adults. You might mention where people can come hear you and maybe continue information, getting information on this topic.
Thanks for that. Absolutely. I mean, for one thing, anybody who wants to follow my blog can do that. I talk about these topics all the time. So it's just look for Greg Cuzzona blog, and it's an unusual name. April 7th on Saturday morning, I'll be doing an event at Bidwell Presbyterian Church in downtown Chico at 8:30, where I'll talk about the book. And anybody who buys a book, the proceeds will go to the Jesus Center. So there's a positive out of that. And then I believe we'll have enough time with this airing to talk about, to say also the March 25th event at St. John's on Sunday.
St. John's Episcopal Church.
On Floral, yes.
On April 20th.
March 25th.
March 25th.
So first St. John's on March 25th, and then that's a Sunday, and then Saturday, April 7th. Yes.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm sure people will want to hear more about this topic if this is interested, if they're open-minded. And I'll remind you again, my guest has been Greg Cuzzona, his newest book, Mere Science and Christian Faith. Chico Friends of the Library invite you to come to the Chico Branch Library next Tuesday, March 27th at 7 p.m. for a reading, discussion, and book signing with New York Times bestselling author J.A. Jantz, author of the mystery Duel to the Death. And just a reminder that Greg Cuzzona, today's guest, will be at St. John's Episcopal Church this Sunday, March 25th. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.